I had delayed my departure from Saigon after I got back in country. Don had had a meeting with some of us in Saigon. They had already sent out telegrams all over the country. The folks in Hue had been captured, and other volunteers, Tom Fox had been injured. Others had hidden in, I don't know if that was Tom or somebody else, had hidden in water tanks and under beds. Somebody hid under a bed in Trump with a family. Was that Lynch? I don't know. Whoever was there. And so the stories are coming back pretty scary. And so Don said that we had the option of leaving or not. And I had made the decision that I wanted to go into Europe and finish out my alternative service. And I had written to the Brethren Service Commission in Elgin, Illinois. Mm-hmm. And they put me in touch with the person in charge in Europe, Dale Ott. Dale's mother lives at Hillcrest. And his sister is moving in. I mean, Hillcrest is family and his relationships. But I had gotten a letter back from Brethren Service Commission at the Church of Brethren that I could go to Europe. And I told them I had transportation. Because I had a ticket from IBS mm-hmm. to go back home, so I traded in on going right. to Europe. Mm-hmm. And so I made the decision that that's what I wanted to do. Others of us, I recall Ron Bean went. Ron Bean went back to Chicago to Bethany Hospital, and we later roomed together at Bethany. Ted Gregory, who's in Yokohama now, or somewhere in that area, is married to a Japanese lady. Ted and I ended up in Germany with Brethren Volunteer Service. So I made that decision, and Don or Gene Stoltz or somebody, it wasn't Don then, because he had already...
Don Whitfield.
Don had given permission for me to go back to Fonon, I was supposed to go up there, get my things, mm-hmm. and come back. And so I went up, I had to get all my stuff packed up, took and shipped it home, except what I was taking to Europe. And then I made arrangements, had goodbyes to everybody at the school and everything. And when I had to go back through Neutron, and I had to go to Neutron, spend a night, and then catch a flight to Saigon. Mm-hmm. That was a mistake. It was Tom Mamiono, who was the acting regional director at the time, became really intense when he saw me, because he didn't know I was coming. And told me to go back to Phan Rang, that I had no permission to go to Saigon. And so I had to go back to Phan Rang. Mm-hmm. And I think I spent the night in Nha Trang, and they told me what the experience was like during the Tet Offensive. Because mm-hmm. the Viet Cong had gone, in a large group of them, several breasts, not how many deep, by the IBS house in Nha Trang. And some of the volunteers had described what it was like. They went to a Tet festival, the Tet services of the temple up mm-hmm. on the hill temple. In Nha Trang. Mm-hmm. And the volunteer that was under the bed had described seeing these men around the temple. And that mm-hmm. it just didn't fit, but he didn't think about being VC. Mm-hmm. And here they were VC. Ready to start the offensive at what midnight or whenever mm-hmm. it was. Anyway, so that was a learning experience, especially with Tom. Went back to Phan Rang, sent a telegram and radio communications down to Saigon, said that I was sent back to Phan Rang, still needed permission to go to Phan Rang to Saigon, and so finally got it. And they contacted Tom and told him it was okay.
Why was Tom playing hardball with you? What?
I have no idea. I think he was.
Want me to ask him?
He may not even remember. Uh-huh. I think he was just the experience.
Yeah, it was just so tense.
The Tet yeah. offensive uh-huh. experience in Neutron was
intense.
Very intense. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a nice word for it. Mm-hmm. It was very frightening mm-hmm. experience. In Phan Rang, in fact, right before I left Phan Rang, I don't recall if it was before I left the first time or the second time, but we had to stay at one of the AID homes. And they had all sorts of weapons in there, which really did not make me feel any more mm-hmm. secure. Mm-hmm. But we were told we had to be there because the Viet Cong might raid our homes mm-hmm. and capture us. Mm-hmm. And already some of the IDSers had been captured. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, this is March. The Tet Offensive was in January, early February. Mm-hmm. So several weeks had passed, and we were told that we had to be over at the house. Mm-hmm. You know, I could have my dates all screwed up now, but and the night before we had to go into that particular house, the town had received a couple mortars. They landed harmlessly. Mm-hmm. And just Phan Rang was not a strategic location for the VC. Mm-hmm. And to my knowledge, it was never subjected to the fighting until the north came down Highway 1 mm-hmm. in 75. Mm-hmm. And a number of people were killed in that experience on whenever that was in April of 75, mm-hmm. March or April. Geez, how some of this comes back.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Neutron thing was... I mean, there were people banging on doors trying to, you know, the VC were trying to apprehend people.
Yeah, well, that did.
But there happen. Was a the problem was in Neutron. It was a, there was a lot of Americans there, and that made it a very big target.
Yeah. Well, in Neutron, the VC did come to the door of this Vietnamese family where the IDSer was mm-hmm. hidden under the bed. You know the Vietnamese yeah. beds.
I think that was Dennis Rostra.
Was it?
I think.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But my picture of a Vietnamese bed is the. Is a hard piece mm-hmm. of wood mm-hmm. that has the sides built on. Mm-hmm. So it's literally sitting on the floor, and mm-hmm. he was under there. And the Viet Cong had been told that there was an American there. And the VC came into the house several times and never found it. Mm. For some reason, they never picked up the bed. Now, wherever that was.
That wasn't it, Dennis.
I thought it was Steve somebody.
Okay.
You know, 30 years. Almost 30 years is a long time to remember that type mm-hmm. of detail.
No, it's perfectly clear to me. Uh-huh. My similar experience, I remember the number of grains of earth that my nose was pressed into, so.
Where, in Afghanistan?
No, well, actually, or that happened there too, but that.
Chad?
No, I don't want to get it on the air.
Oh, okay.
I'll just finish that. I really just want to talk about leaving Vietnam and things you did afterwards, and just a quick postmortem. When Don gave you all that kind of speech, so to speak, like those of you can leave now, and you decided you wanted to go to Europe, what were your emotions about that? I mean, do you feel you've done well? I don't want to put any words in your mouth. What did you feel?
I hadn't completed my assignment in Vietnam. That was really frustrating. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think of what I thought about then versus what I realized later. I could have stayed in Vietnam. It would have been fairly safe mm-hmm. until June or July, and finished my 2 years. And then I could have done the traveling that I had wanted to and never have had the opportunity since. Because mm-hmm. I was going to go overseas, overland, mm-hmm. for back to Europe, and mm-hmm. Spent a lot of time doing that, and I didn't do it. Mm-hmm. But what I recall then is the frustration, two things, the fear for personal safety, mm-hmm. and for the first time realize that, you know, this is a dangerous situation, and the frustration of leaving students and my Vietnamese friends, the teachers, that they had to face whatever was coming. And it turns out that it was another 8 years of war before it was over. But just that in March of 68, it was, what can I do to get out and get to Europe so I can finish my alternative service and not have any problems with the draft board back in mm-hmm. Goshen, Indiana. Yeah. That was part of it, Mark.
Oh, no, I understand that. I just want you to be able to articulate this as clear enough. It's not actually a big point. But Don says, you know, those of you who want to leave can leave. You evaluate the situation saying, gee, I really want to finish my work.
That's my recollection today.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Without
them. Well, you might look at your papers here. You might have written a letter home or something. But the only reason I'm asking is I'd love to recreate the atmosphere of Don's speech to everyone. And there, look at the different reactions that people.
I don't know if I was there when he gave a speech.
No. But when you
say, but other than that, when I got back into Vietnam from my R&R trip, and I've been gone for like 3 or 4 weeks, Bruce Holder was the office person there, and we had been long family friends for years. Our parents were old friends. And we were packing up David's things. If I recall, we had the two main houses of IVS with the veranda in between. And then off to one side there was a garage. And the gas tank was out here somewhere, and there were a whole bunch of trees. But I can recall going out from the office and going over, and Dave's things were out here in this building out here. The airport's over here. And just putting that stuff together and helping Bruce do it. And what was the purpose? You know, what were we here for? Even then, the rumor was the Vietnamese army had killed him. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was just a few days after he'd been killed, or a couple of weeks, and it was scary because you didn't know who your friends were then. I mean, if the Vietnamese army was doing it, it wasn't the Viet Cong that we should be afraid of. It was the people that were supposed to be helping. I don't recall now how we got it, how that box got shipped out, but it was a couple trunks of stuff.
Were you at the Katzenbach Memorial thing that they had?
Not for Nick, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, when Nick?
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
I was there.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about that.
And then afterwards we got together for refreshments.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even remember where we got together. Or what year that was. I presume that was in between 69 and 71.
Mm-hmm. Or 72. 71. Yeah, it was somewhere around, it was in the early 70s.
Because before we went to Arizona, I was at UCLA at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I did my master's in school public health.
Mm-hmm. So you went through all this self-evaluation, and there were other people, of course, who were deciding that. One of the things we're looking at it is, did IVSers feel at the time that given the Tet Offensive, it would be really very possible to do their work? That the war was like reaching a tempo which made this kind of
thing. Tet Offensive compromised what we were trying to accomplish, mm-hmm. or at least American response, and American response to it. Because it was so clear that this was a war. It wasn't just a police action. It was that's a whole other issue that we were there as civilians and supposedly at the invitation of the government, and that we were under civilian control, not under military control. And that attitude on my part, well, that plus my attitude almost got me kicked out of Vietnam in 1967 anyway, when I got arrested for Dick Avery and I were picked up by the MPs for curfew violation because we were walking home from a party at the house that got blown up. We were walking home from that house back to our place, and the MPs drove along and shined their flashlights from our feet up to our face, and and then took us out their base and gave us a, said we were arrested for curfew violation. Mm-hmm. We had no paper to prove it, mm-hmm. but they said we were arrested. mm-hmm. And I protested the next day to the military commanders, and that upset the local MACV commander. No end. Mm-hmm. Because we reported to Larry Lawrence, the chief of party of the civilians, and, mm-hmm. and Larry's a former IBSer, so mm-hmm. Larry had a tough job to take these volunteers and try to keep them from getting into trouble with the military. Mm-hmm.
But how did that play on your take on after 10? In other words, you already had run-ins with the military.
I remember the night we were walking over to the AI, another government villa, where we had to spend that night, sometime in February or March of '68. And I remember Gordon Cornell, who was a State Department Foreign Service officer, saying to us that our security could not be assured anymore. And that was more in reference to some of the Vietnamese that we may be with, that they weren't sure of where their sympathies were, mm-hmm. I presume.
Yes.
And then having to spend that night over there, or whatever it was, it just made the work. And from Phan Rang to Top Chom was 3 or 4 miles, mm-hmm. that ride by scooter, and through the countryside. And even though it was heavily traveled by the military, it still wasn't. Mm-hmm. There weren't police all along the way, mm-hmm. so it just made it very difficult.
That validates. I'll get back to you on this when we actually write it up, because what Cornell said makes a lot of sense in other respects. So when we write it up,
David was one of these young college graduates that worked at the State Department in 1965 to 66, mm-hmm. 64 to 66, somewhere in that time frame, that he personally approved bombing runs that were requested by the military, mm-hmm. for the war in Vietnam, and that was at State.
When he was at State,
before mm-hmm. he was assigned to Vietnam, mm-hmm. to Ninh Thuan province.
Well, he had an ambassador rank?
No, he was a FSO.
Okay.
He was in his first 2 or 3 okay. years of being.
Because I've met several FSOs that were, in other words, the chief ranking state official in each province got an ambassador rank. So like,
okay, well, Larry Lawrence was mm-hmm. our chief of party. Mm-hmm. In the
how do you spell his last
name? Lavrentz. He's okay. in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. He's still with the Department of Health and Human Services, mm-hmm. I believe. Mm-hmm. Last time I saw him was about 10 years ago, and he was doing refugee work, mm-hmm. especially with the Hmong folks from Laos. Mm-hmm. But Larry was IVS mm-hmm. in the early years also, okay. and then joined AID. In fact, in Kansas City,
spell his name, last name for me.
Lawrence, Lavrentz. Wonderful gentleman. I had a lot of respect for him. I still do. He was very empathetic with some of my views. I can recall, and there's just one incident, mm-hmm. but he was invited out to the air base, the Phan Rang Air Base, when the Air Force dedicated a new dormitory for their airmen. Mm-hmm. And I can recall Larry coming back and almost in tears saying, if we had just used that money, and there's millions of dollars, to help the Vietnamese infrastructure development, that would have won more hearts and minds than supporting the war effort. I mean, if we could have taken just a portion of that military money that was being spent in Vietnam and use it to develop housing, use it in agricultural projects, use it to keep the canal open that the military wouldn't let them close that year in 67. And so it flooded because the Vietnamese weren't allowed to clean it out as they normally do every year. And that lost a lot of prestige for the Americans when that happened a year before the Tet Offensive.
And he was the senior.
Larry was a senior. Well, he was AID.
Yes, he had been. Well, was it, when he made this comment to you, was he?
He was still AID.
He was AID. Okay.
Yeah, and David Cornell was a FSO assigned to Ninh Thuan Province.
Now Larry was, what was his rank at that time? He was chief of province.
Chief of province for the Americans.
Was this like 60, well this must have been 67.
66 or 68.
Okay.
And the comment was in 67.
67, okay. Because right now
And Gordon Cornell. That's his name.
Okay.
Gordon Cornell.
Yeah, I thought you said Gordon before.
Yeah, Gordon Cornell. Uh-huh. I have no idea where he is. I'm sure State Department.
I'm more interested in Larry because it might be interesting to talk to several people. IVS USAID. I've met a couple, but not from Vietnam yet. Mm-hmm. So that would be very good. Well, just quickly, when you left Vietnam and you went to Germany, well, how did your life? You met a Filipino wife. You didn't meet her in Europe.
That was in Chicago.
Okay.
2 months later.
Uh-huh.
A year later. Mm-hmm. I finally got to Berlin, and I got into Rome on April 1. When did President Johnson announce that he would not run again? March 31st.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember that morning.
Yeah, I remember that. Like, yes,
I was in Bombay at the Mission Guest House.
Uh-huh.
And
Bombay and the Mission Guest House near Apollo Bunder?
I have no idea.
I would imagine I stayed in that
Betty Blickenstaff, who's one of our residents here. Because I had revisited Betty and Leonard up at Onkelechvaart earlier.
But we actually stayed at that. I think my wife and I weren't married then, and that was a problem to stay. So we had to stay in separate, separate things.
Very nice home. And what was it, Betty's father or Leonard's? Must have been Leonard's father ran that guest house 70, 80 years ago.
But then you...
And he was another one of our residents.
What was your feeling when DLBJ announced his?
I was delighted, absolutely delighted. And my host, a minister, was very sad at my delight. And then he prayed about it. I can recall that.
Mm.
That picture of Johnson looking very haggard.
Very haggard. Yeah.
Very haggard. And I said, oh, good. The war may be over soon, and this is... 7 years.
I think you were wrong. You have been wrong in your life.
I have been.
Yeah. That's happy home.
So that day I flew to Beirut. And in early April I was in Rome and then up to Geneva a day or two later. And I met Dale.
Well, when you finished your work in Europe and you made your way back to the States.
So the States.
Mm-hmm. What?
Christmas Eve, 1968.
Uh-huh. And just briefly, sketch, what were the kind of the things you did after that? You went to school?
Well, even when I was in Europe, I finished my alternative service in the end of Berlin at Evangelisches Johannesstift, which is a German Protestant church's institution out in Spandau.
Mm-hmm.
And worked in a nursing home as an orderly, along with a number of other CEOs, Quaker Mennonite brethren. Did that until just enough to finish my alternative service. Mm-hmm. I finished in early July. In fact, the first night at Johannesstift was my first night in Berlin, and I woke up to the sound of artillery fire. And I was on the floor very quickly, and I said, what was that? And because it sounded like, you know, the guns, but found out later it was the British practicing at 3 o'clock in the morning. did that. Then went down to Spain and worked in a Catholic parish for about 4 or 5 months, just to add on some more time, because I wanted to stay in Europe, and I was interested in going to Spain. And so I went down and took the place of another volunteer down there, lived with a Spanish family that I hope to see again next year in June. And when we were putting on a conference in Barcelona, traveled from November to December 24th through Eastern Europe a little bit, and France, up through France, over to Berlin, or down to Munich, and then up through Czechoslovakia. And this is December of 68, a few months after the Russians invaded Czechoslovakia. And Dubček was still in whitewash on the wall, which is really fascinating. And I was going up to visit one of my church classmates who was in Krakow doing his alternative service, and compare notes and found out he heard all the Russian jets going overhead in August on their way to staging areas for the invasion. But I spent a few days in Krakow, visited Auschwitz, Birkenau, in December, which is a great time to get some of the feeling and weather experience of what the Holocaust was like. Vivid memories of that visit.
It's one of those reasons why you shouldn't have a photographic memory. I can see Dachau-like, it's right there.
Well, I've been to Dachau 3 or 4 times now, and took our family a year and a half or two ago, because we wanted the kids to understand what happened.
And you know, there are no barracks there, but the sterility of the place is more frightening than the reality.
Well, Mark, maybe to you and I, but I don't know that it made an impression on the kids yet. Because they didn't want to spend time in the exhibit room, which is pretty graphic.
Yeah, there was a black sergeant and his wife standing there weeping, with the last time I was there. So that's, you know, it's got this graphic power to be able to affect people no matter how distant they are. But the thing is,
how many times you visit?
Now, what you think is, you could drop a cigarette. I mean, you couldn't. Lint, if it fell from your body, led to punishment. The place was absolutely immaculate at all times, except of course the areas where they had to all sleep. But the idea is every latrines had to be sparkling, and it's that kind of rigid, that frightening rigidity, which of course is what scares me about fundamentalism everywhere, world over.
The latrines were sparkling, but at Auschwitz they weren't.
No.
They were gross at Auschwitz. And then later, well, since 68, hearing more and more stories about the survivors and what they went through. How much of that visit in 68 do I remember versus how much they added to my memory by all the newsreels and the, you know, and the survivors.
When you got back to
I got back on Christmas Eve to my family, and came back on Icelandic Air, and then from New York City back to Fort Wayne, and from Fort Wayne, I hitched a ride with a brother and minister whose daughter was on my flight, just coincidentally. And I don't know how these things work, but they that was got home that night. And then after that, I'd already applied to graduate school. I knew I wanted to go into hospital administration. And so,
when did you decide you'd go into hospital administration?
In 1968.
In
Vietnam, I had gotten acquainted with a couple of the hospital administrators at the provincial hospital, and they treated me very well because I had often had dysentery, and I was over there so much anyway. And spent a lot of time in the laboratory where they were processing my specimens. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
And but see, we ate on the local economy, mm-hmm. and I got sick quite often. And in the spring of, was it the spring or summer of 67, I had such a bad case of amoebic dysentery that, you know, the British, one of the British surgeons took me home and had given me two IVs to keep me alive, and then made sure that I was being watched because we didn't, our cook wasn't at home for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so he could keep an eye on me.
You applied to graduate
and,
school.
Then I, so in 68, then when I was in, I may have started in Berlin, but especially by the time I was in Spain, that fall of 68, I applied to graduate school, mm-hmm. to seven or eight graduate schools. And I really wanted to go to UCLA. And so when I got home in January, I had already written and said I'd like to come visit these different schools. And so I did. Yeah. And I had already arranged an itinerary, reconfirmed it when I got back to the States. And I visited Duke and the University of Michigan, Washington University in St. Louis, UCLA.
When did you visit UCLA, do you remember?
Oh, January.
January of 1969.
69, and I saw June Pulcini. I don't recall who all I saw, but I visited with the program directors of the hospital administration programs in each of these universities.
Mm-hmm.
And